A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants a deep dive into the histamine system. Specifically, three questions. 1. What's the actual difference between the H1 and H2 receptors? Because they show up in totally different contexts, and nobody explains why. 2. Do the antihistamines people take for sleep actually have any meaningful anti-allergy effect, or is that a separate thing entirely? And 3. This is a big one. How can a single chemical system be responsible for both allergic reactions and keeping you awake? Those seem like completely unrelated jobs. There's a lot to unpack here.
There really is. And I love this question because histamine is one of those molecules that does wildly different things depending on where it's released and which receptor catches it. Most people know it as the thing that makes you sneeze during pollen season, but it's also the reason you're conscious right now.
Wait, right now? As in, if my histamine system shut off mid-sentence, I'd just...
You'd fall asleep. Not gradually, not drowsily. The brain's wakefulness system would go dark. This is why first-generation antihistamines knock people out. It's not a side effect. It's literally the main job of histamine in the brain being blocked.
That's already blowing my mind a little. The same molecule that makes my nose run is keeping me awake.
That gets right to Daniel's third question. The apparent disconnect. But before we go there, let's lay the groundwork with the receptors, because that's where the explanation lives. By the way, quick note, today's episode script is coming from DeepSeek V4 Pro.
DeepSeek in the booth. All right, walk me through H1 versus H2. I know they're different drug targets, but what's actually different about them?
Both are histamine receptors. They're proteins that sit in cell membranes and wait for histamine to flow by and bind to them. But they're coupled to completely different signaling systems inside the cell, and they're distributed in completely different tissues. H1 receptors are found in smooth muscle, in the endothelial cells that line your blood vessels, and crucially for our conversation, in the brain. When histamine hits H1 in your nasal passages, you get vasodilation, increased vascular permeability, fluid leakage, that's the runny nose, the swelling, the redness. In the brain, H1 activation in the cortex and thalamus promotes wakefulness and attention.
H1 is the receptor that explains both halves of Daniel's question. Allergy symptoms and wakefulness. Same receptor, different locations.
H2 is a different beast entirely. H2 receptors are found mainly in the stomach lining on the parietal cells that produce gastric acid. When histamine binds to H2 there, it triggers a cascade that pumps hydrogen ions into the stomach. That's hydrochloric acid. This is why H2 blockers like cimetidine, ranitidine, famotidine were the standard treatment for acid reflux and ulcers before proton pump inhibitors took over.
Right, tagamet-san, dacpepsid. I remember those. So H2 has nothing to do with allergies and nothing to do with wakefulness.
There are actually H2 receptors in the brain too, but their role in sleep-wake regulation is much less pronounced than H1. The tuberomammillary nucleus, this is the brain's main histamine factory, we'll get to it. It projects histamine throughout the cortex, and those projections primarily hit H1 receptors to maintain arousal. H2 in the brain seems to be involved in things like feeding behavior and cognitive function, but it's not the wakefulness switch.
That's a helpful distinction. So when someone takes Benadryl for sleep, they're blocking H1, not H2, which means their stomach acid is unaffected.
Diphenhydramine. Benadryl is a first-generation H1 antagonist that crosses the blood-brain barrier very effectively. It blocks H1 receptors in the periphery, which is how it reduces allergy symptoms, and it blocks H1 receptors in the brain, which is how it causes sedation. Doxylamine, the active ingredient in Unisome and NyQuil, same story. It's actually slightly more potent as a sedative than diphenhydramine and has a longer half-life.
Daniel's second question. Do these sleep aid antihistamines have real anti-allergy effects? The answer seems to be yes, they're genuine antihistamines. The sedation isn't a weird quirk. It's the same mechanism in a different tissue.
Right. And this is where the history of these drugs gets fascinating. When diphenhydramine was first synthesized in the 1940s, it was actually the first H1 antihistamine ever developed. It was purely for allergies. The sedation was considered an unwanted side effect. The drug's inventor, George Riefenstahl, was a chemical engineering professor at the University of Cincinnati, and he was trying to find something to counteract the effects of histamine in allergic reactions. The drowsiness was a problem they kept noting in early trials.
Now people take it specifically for that drowsiness.
Which is a complete inversion. But here's the thing. Using first-generation antihistamines as sleep aids is pharmacologically messy. They're not selective. Diphenhydramine also blocks muscarinic acetylcholine receptors, which is why it causes dry mouth, blurred vision, urinary retention, constipation. It blocks alpha-adrenergic receptors to some degree. It's a dirty drug, pharmacologically speaking. When you take it for sleep, you're getting the H1 blockade you want, but you're also getting a whole cocktail of other effects you don't want.
If someone has actual allergies and also can't sleep, diphenhydramine kills two birds with one stone. But if someone just wants sleep, they're taking a sledgehammer to a problem that newer drugs address with more precision.
And the newer sleep medications, the Z drugs like Zolpidem, the orexin antagonists like suvorexant, they don't touch histamine at all. They work on completely different systems. Which brings us back to that third question, the one I think is most interesting. How does a molecule associated with allergic reactions also run the brain's wakefulness system?
Yeah, let's get into that. Because on the surface, there's no obvious evolutionary logic. Why would the same chemical signal that tells your nose to swell up also tell your brain to stay conscious?
The key to understanding this is the tuberomammillary nucleus. I mentioned it earlier. The TMN is a tiny cluster of neurons in the posterior hypothalamus. We're talking maybe 64,000 neurons in the human brain, which is minuscule compared to the billions of neurons in the cortex. But these neurons are the sole source of histamine in the entire brain. Every bit of histamine your brain uses for wakefulness comes from this one little nucleus.
64,000 neurons running the whole wakefulness show?
They project everywhere. The TMN sends histaminergic fibers to the cortex, the thalamus, the basal forebrain, the brainstem arousal centers. It's a diffuse projection system, meaning a small number of neurons can influence vast swaths of brain tissue. The TMN fires rapidly when you're awake and alert, slows down during drowsiness, and goes almost completely silent during REM sleep.
It's literally a wakefulness switch, or at least one of several.
It's part of what's called the ascending reticular activating system, the network of brainstem and hypothalamic nuclei that maintain consciousness. The TMN is the histamine branch of that system. Other branches use norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, orexin. They all converge on the cortex to keep you awake, but they use different neurotransmitters. Histamine is one of the major ones.
That still doesn't explain why histamine. Why not some other molecule? Why reuse the allergic reaction chemical?
This is where evolutionary biology gives us a really elegant answer. Histamine is an ancient molecule. It's found in virtually all animals, and even in some plants and bacteria. It's synthesized from the amino acid histidine by an enzyme called histidine decarboxylase. The evolutionary origin of histamine as a signaling molecule likely predates the split between the immune system and the nervous system. In early organisms, there was no distinction. A single chemical signal could coordinate both defense responses and behavioral states.
In a primitive organism, there's a pathogen, mount an immune response, and there's a threat. Stay alert. Might have been the same signal.
That's the hypothesis. Think about what an allergic reaction actually is. It's your immune system mounting a defense against something that isn't actually dangerous. The symptoms of an allergic reaction, the swelling, the mucus production, the itching, those are all mechanisms to expel or wall off an invader. And if you're fighting off an invader, you probably shouldn't be asleep. You should be awake and dealing with it.
That makes a lot of sense. Sickness behavior in general tends to disrupt sleep.
And histamine is part of that coordination. When your immune system detects a threat, mast cells release histamine locally, which creates inflammation and recruits other immune cells. But histamine can also cross into the brain or be released centrally, and that signals the TMN to increase arousal. It's a unified response, body and brain both mobilized.
The connection isn't a coincidence. It's a deep evolutionary link between immune activation and vigilance. The same signal says, defend the perimeter and stay awake to guard the perimeter.
This is why I find the histamine system so elegant. It's not two unrelated functions awkwardly sharing a molecule. It's one coherent function, mobilize the organism, that got specialized into different tissues over evolutionary time. The mast cells in your nose and the neurons in your TMN are using the same chemical language to coordinate a whole body response.
When I take an antihistamine for allergies, the drowsiness isn't a side effect at all. It's the exact same mechanism doing exactly what it evolved to do, just in a different part of the body.
In fact, you could argue that the anti-allergy effect is the one that's more evolutionarily recent and specialized. The wakefulness function is the ancient one. Histamine's role in the brain is closer to its original purpose.
That's a complete reframing. Most people think of histamine as an allergy chemical that weirdly also affects sleep. But you're saying it's a vigilance chemical that the immune system later co-opted.
There's evidence for this when you look at the distribution of histamine across species. Invertebrates use histamine as a neurotransmitter extensively. In fruit flies, histamine is the main neurotransmitter for photoreceptors. It's how they see light. In the mammalian brain, histamine's role narrowed but didn't disappear. The TMN system is evolutionarily conserved across all vertebrates.
Let me ask about the flip side. If histamine promotes wakefulness, what happens when the system goes wrong? Are there disorders of too much or too little histamine signaling in the brain?
Narcolepsy is the classic example, though it's more directly tied to orexin deficiency. But histamine is definitely involved. People with narcolepsy have significantly reduced histamine levels in their cerebrospinal fluid. And there's a fascinating connection to the orexin system. Orexin neurons in the lateral hypothalamus project to and excite the TMN. So when orexin is missing, as in narcolepsy type 1, the TMN doesn't get its normal activation. Histamine release drops and wakefulness becomes fragmented.
Orexin is upstream of histamine in the wakefulness circuit.
Orexin is like the conductor, and histamine is one of the musicians. If the conductor disappears, the histamine section goes quiet. But the other musicians, norepinephrine, serotonin, acetylcholine, they're still playing somewhat, which is why narcolepsy isn't just constant sleep. It's fragmented wakefulness punctuated by sleep attacks.
What about the other direction? Too much histamine signaling?
But also, there's intriguing research linking histamine dysfunction to schizophrenia and Tourette syndrome. The first generation antipsychotics actually blocked H1 receptors pretty potently, and some researchers think part of their sedating effect came from that, not just dopamine blockade. More recently, there's been interest in H3 receptors.
Wait, there's an H3.
There are actually 4 histamine receptors, H1, H2, H3, and H4. H3 is primarily in the brain, and it's an autoreceptor. It sits on the histamine neurons themselves and regulates histamine release. When histamine binds to H3, it tells the neuron to stop releasing more histamine. It's a negative feedback loop.
H3 is the brake pedal for the histamine system.
And this has made H3 a really interesting drug target. H3 antagonists block that brake pedal, so histamine release increases. These drugs promote wakefulness. Pitolisant is an H3 inverse agonist that was approved for narcolepsy. It works by boosting the brain's own histamine signaling rather than replacing it with a stimulant.
That's clever. Instead of adding an external wakefulness signal, you just remove the inhibition on the existing one.
It's much cleaner pharmacologically than something like modafinil or amphetamines. Pitolisant doesn't have the same abuse potential, doesn't affect dopamine directly in the same way. It's a really elegant approach.
Let me pull us back to Daniel's second question for a moment, about whether sleep antihistamines have real anti-allergy effects. We established that diphenhydramine and doxylamine do, because they're genuine H1 antagonists. But what about the sedative effect itself? Is there any evidence that taking these drugs for sleep actually helps with allergies incidentally?
That's a slightly different question, and the answer is yes, but it depends on timing. If you take diphenhydramine at night for sleep, you are getting H1 blockade in your nasal passages and skin during those hours. If your allergies are worse at night or in the early morning, which is common with dust mite allergies, then a nighttime dose is actually doing double duty. By morning, though, the drug has mostly worn off, so daytime allergy symptoms won't be helped.
What about tolerance? I've heard that the sedative effect of antihistamines wears off quickly with repeated use.
This is well documented, and it's a real problem. The sedative effect of diphenhydramine shows significant tolerance within 3 to 4 days of continuous use. The H1 receptors in the brain adapt to chronic blockade. But here's the interesting part. The peripheral anti-allergy effect doesn't seem to develop the same tolerance. The receptors in your nose and skin respond differently than the ones in your brain.
That seems strange. Same receptor, different tolerance profile?
It's not fully understood, but the leading hypothesis is that the blood-brain barrier creates different pharmacokinetics in the central nervous system versus the periphery. The brain's H1 receptors might be exposed to different concentrations of the drug over time, or the receptor regulation mechanisms differ between tissues. But clinically, it's a real phenomenon. People can take cetirizine or loratadine daily for allergies and get consistent relief without sedation, because those second-generation antihistamines don't cross the blood-brain barrier well. But if they take diphenhydramine daily for sleep, the sleep benefit diminishes quickly.
The practical takeaway is, don't use first-generation antihistamines as a long-term sleep solution. They stop working for that purpose.
You're still getting the anticholinergic effects, which don't diminish as much, so you end up with dry mouth and constipation without the sleep benefit. It's the worst of both worlds.
That's a rough deal. What about the second-generation antihistamines? Loratadine, cetirizine, fexofenadine. Why don't they cause drowsiness?
It's purely about blood-brain barrier penetration. The second-generation drugs were specifically designed to be substrates for P-glycoprotein, which is an efflux transporter that pumps foreign molecules out of the brain. So they get into the bloodstream, they block H1 receptors in the periphery, but as soon as they try to cross into the brain, P-glycoprotein shoves them right back out.
They're not less potent at the receptor level. They just can't reach the brain receptors.
Cetirizine is actually a metabolite of hydroxyzine, which is a first-generation antihistamine that's quite sedating. The parent drug crosses the blood-brain barrier, the metabolite largely doesn't. Same receptor affinity, completely different side effect profile.
That's a neat bit of medicinal chemistry. So if someone has allergies and insomnia, you could theoretically give them a second-gen antihistamine during the day and something else entirely for sleep.
That's exactly the standard approach now. Use loratadine or fexofenadine for daytime allergy control. And if sleep is a problem, address it with something that targets sleep systems directly. Melatonin agonists, orexin antagonists, or cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which has the best long-term evidence.
Let's circle back to the TMN for a minute. You said it goes silent during REM sleep. What actually turns it off?
This is where the sleep-wake circuitry gets really beautiful. The TMN is inhibited by the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus, the VLPO, which is the brain's main sleep-promoting center. The VLPO is in the anterior hypothalamus, and it sends GABAergic inhibitory projections to all the arousal centers, including the TMN. When you're awake, the TMN is firing and the VLPO is quiet. When you fall asleep, the VLPO activates and shuts down the TMN.
It's a flip-flop switch. Awake mode, TMN on, VLPO off. Sleep mode, VLPO on, TMN off.
That's the model. And the orexin system stabilizes the switch. Orexin excites the TMN and other arousal centers, and it also excites itself. It has positive feedback. This keeps you firmly in one state or the other. Without orexin, the switch becomes unstable, which is why narcoleptics flip between wake and sleep unpredictably.
Where does adenosine fit in? That's the molecule that caffeine blocks, right?
Adenosine is the sleep pressure chemical. It builds up in the brain during wakefulness, and it inhibits the arousal centers, including the TMN. Caffeine works by blocking adenosine receptors, which releases the TMN from that inhibition. That's why caffeine keeps you awake. It's taking the brake off the histamine system.
Caffeine and histamine are on opposite sides of the wakefulness tug of war.
Caffeine doesn't touch histamine directly. It blocks adenosine, and adenosine normally inhibits the TMN. So caffeine disinhibits histamine release. It's one step removed, but it's part of the same network.
This whole system is remarkably interconnected. You got orexin, histamine, adenosine, GABA. All these different molecules converging on the same question of whether you're conscious or not.
That redundancy makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Wakefulness is too important to entrust to a single chemical system. If one fails, others can compensate. The brain has multiple parallel arousal pathways precisely because being awake is non-negotiable for survival.
Unless you're me, I could sleep through most survival threats.
You're a sloth. Your entire genus is an exception to every rule of mammalian physiology.
Let's talk about histamine and the immune system a bit more. You mentioned mast cells. What's the actual mechanism there?
Mast cells are immune cells that reside in tissues, especially at boundaries with the external environment, skin, lungs, gut. They're loaded with granules containing preformed histamine. When an allergen binds to IgE antibodies on the mast cell surface, it triggers degranulation. The cell dumps its histamine into the surrounding tissue within seconds.
It's a rapid response system. The histamine is pre-made and ready to go.
It's not like the cell needs to synthesize histamine on demand. It's sitting there in vesicles, waiting for a signal. When the signal comes, boom. Local histamine concentration spikes, blood vessels dilate, smooth muscle contracts, nerve endings get irritated. That's the wheal and flare response you see in an allergy skin test.
This is completely independent from the TMN histamine. Different cells, different triggers, same molecule.
The mast cells use histidine decarboxylase to make histamine from histidine, just like the TMN neurons do. But the mast cells are responding to immune signals. IgE cross-linking, complement activation, physical injury, while the TMN neurons are responding to synaptic inputs from other brain regions. Same biosynthetic pathway, completely different control systems.
That's a really important distinction. The histamine is the same, but the regulatory logic is totally separate.
This explains why you can have allergies without being wide awake, and why you can be wide awake without allergy symptoms. The two systems operate independently even though they use the same signaling molecule.
Which means Daniel's third question. How can one system do both things? Has a satisfying answer. It's not one system. It's two systems that happen to use the same chemical vocabulary.
That's the heart of it. And once you understand that, the whole thing clicks into place. The immune system and the central nervous system both adopted histamine early in evolution, and they've maintained it because it works. There's no need to evolve a separate molecule for wakefulness when histamine already does the job.
Let me ask you about something. Are there foods that affect histamine levels? I've heard about histamine intolerance. People who get headaches and flushing from certain foods.
Histamine intolerance is a real but controversial condition. The idea is that some people have reduced activity of diamine oxidase, which is the enzyme that breaks down histamine in the gut. When they eat histamine-rich foods, aged cheese, fermented foods, wine, cured meats, the histamine isn't degraded properly, it gets absorbed into the bloodstream, and it causes symptoms that mimic an allergic reaction.
It's not an allergy because there's no IEE involved.
It's a metabolic issue, not an immune issue. The histamine is coming from the food, not from the person's own mast cells. And the symptoms, headache, flushing, diarrhea, sometimes palpitations, are caused by histamine acting on H1 and H2 receptors throughout the body.
Can that affect sleep?
If you have high circulating histamine, it could theoretically increase arousal. But histamine in the bloodstream doesn't easily cross the blood-brain barrier in adults, so the effect on the TMN would be indirect at best. More likely, the sleep disturbance is from discomfort, headache, gut symptoms, rather than direct histamine signaling in the brain.
That's reassuring. So my midnight cheese binges aren't directly waking up my TMN.
Though the tyramine in aged cheese can trigger migraines in susceptible people, and that'll definitely ruin your sleep.
Let's talk about the H2 side for a moment. You mentioned chimetidine and famotidine. Why did proton pump inhibitors largely replace them?
PPIs like omeprazole are more effective at suppressing stomach acid because they block the final common pathway, the proton pump itself, rather than just one of the signals that activates it. Histamine is only one of three pathways to stimulate acid secretion. Gastrin and acetylcholine are the other two. An H2 blocker only blocks the histamine pathway. A PPI blocks all three.
If you block H2, the stomach can still make acid in response to food or gastrin.
H2 blockers reduce acid secretion by maybe 70%. PPIs can reduce it by over 90%. For severe reflux or ulcers, that difference matters.
Any central nervous system effects from H2 blockers? Do they affect sleep or wakefulness?
The early H2 blockers, especially cimetidine, could cause confusion and hallucinations in elderly patients or people with kidney impairment. But that's not because of histamine in the brain. Quimetidine crosses the blood-brain barrier to some degree and has off-target effects. The newer ones like famotidine have much less of this. None of them cause drowsiness the way H1 blockers do because they're not hitting the brain's wakefulness receptors.
If you take Pepcid for heartburn, you're not going to get sleepy.
And you're also not going to get allergy relief because H2 receptors aren't involved in the classic allergic response. It's a completely separate indication.
This receptor specificity is really elegant. Same molecule, four different receptors, completely different physiological roles depending on which receptor is where.
The drug development story follows that logic perfectly. H1 blockers for allergies and sleep. H2 blockers for acid. H3 drugs for narcolepsy and potentially other wakefulness disorders. H4 is the newest. It's primarily on immune cells, and there's interest in H4 blockers for inflammatory conditions like asthma and rheumatoid arthritis.
Four receptors. Four therapeutic categories. That's satisfying.
It really is. And it illustrates something important about pharmacology. A lot of people think of drugs as either fixing a problem or causing side effects. But the reality is that every drug hits multiple targets to some degree. The art is in making it selective enough that the therapeutic effect dominates.
The first generation antihistamines are the opposite of selective.
They're a blunt instrument, and they were revolutionary in the 1940s, the first real treatment for allergies. But we've gotten much more sophisticated since then. Taking diphenhydramine for sleep in 2026 is using a 75-year-old sledgehammer when we have scalpels available.
Though the scalpels aren't over-the-counter in the same way, diphenhydramine is cheap and accessible.
That's the trade-off. Accessibility versus specificity. And for occasional use, diphenhydramine is fine for most people. The problem is chronic use, nightly for months or years. That's where the anticholinergic burden accumulates, and there's now good evidence linking long-term anticholinergic use to increased dementia risk.
That's a serious concern. And most people taking Benadryl for sleep have no idea.
There was a large study published in JAMA Internal Medicine a few years back that found a statistically significant association between cumulative anticholinergic use and incident dementia. Diphenhydramine was one of the drugs tracked. The hazard ratio wasn't enormous, but it was real and it was dose-dependent.
The more you take over your lifetime, the higher the risk.
Which is why the American Geriatric Society strongly recommends against using diphenhydramine as a sleep aid in older adults. It's on their BIRS list of potentially inappropriate medications.
Good to know. So what should someone use instead? You mentioned orexin antagonists earlier.
Suvorexant, lemborexant, daridorexant. These are the dual orexin receptor antagonists, or DORAs. They work by blocking orexin signaling, which, as we discussed, is upstream of histamine in the wakefulness circuit. They don't directly touch histamine, but they reduce the orexin drive that keeps the TMN active. It's a more targeted approach.
They don't have the anticholinergic baggage.
No anticholinergic effects at all. They're much cleaner. The downside is they're prescription only and expensive. But from a purely pharmacological standpoint, they're vastly superior to diphenhydramine for chronic insomnia.
What about melatonin? Where does that fit in?
Melatonin is a different system entirely. It's the darkness signal from the pineal gland. It doesn't directly induce sleep. It tells the circadian clock that it's nighttime, which permits sleep to occur. It's a permissive signal, not a sedative. That's why melatonin's effect size in clinical trials for insomnia is modest. It helps with circadian rhythm disorders much more than with straightforward sleep maintenance insomnia.
Melatonin, orexin, histamine, three completely separate levers for influencing sleep, each with different mechanisms and different appropriate uses.
That's before you even get to the GABA system, which is what benzodiazepines and Z drugs target. Sleep regulation is distributed across multiple parallel systems precisely because it's so critical. Evolution doesn't put all its eggs in one basket for essential functions.
This has been a genuinely clarifying conversation. Before we started, I thought of histamine as basically the allergy molecule. Now I'm seeing it as this ancient, multi-purpose signaling system that coordinates immune defense and behavioral arousal through the same chemical language.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. And Daniel's question, how can one system do both things? The answer is that it's not one system. It's one molecule deployed by two different systems for related evolutionary purposes. The mast cell and the TMN neuron are like two different agencies using the same radio frequency. They don't interfere with each other because they're in different locations with different transmitters and receivers.
The drugs that block histamine work wherever the molecule is acting, which is why an H1 blocker affects both allergies and wakefulness. The drug doesn't know whether it's in your nose or your hypothalamus. It just binds to the receptor.
Which is both the power and the limitation of systemic pharmacology. You can't easily target one tissue without affecting others that express the same receptor. The second generation antihistamines solved this for allergies by staying out of the brain. The H2 blockers solved it for acid by targeting a different receptor entirely. The H3 drugs are solving it for wakefulness by modulating the brain's own histamine release rather than blocking receptors everywhere.
It's a really satisfying arc from the first clumsy antihistamines to the current generation of targeted drugs. And it all comes back to understanding the basic biology of where histamine is made, where it's released, and which receptors catch it.
That's why I love this topic. It's a perfect example of how basic science, understanding receptor subtypes, mapping neural circuits, tracing evolutionary history, leads directly to better medicines. Diphenhydramine was discovered essentially by screening chemicals and seeing what worked. The newer drugs were designed based on molecular understanding.
Any final thoughts on where this is heading? Are there drugs in the pipeline that target histamine in new ways?
The H3 space is still active. There's interest in H3 antagonists for ADH, D for cognitive impairment in schizophrenia, for excessive daytime sleepiness beyond narcolepsy, and the H4 receptor is being explored for inflammatory and autoimmune conditions. But the most interesting frontier might be understanding individual variation. Some people are much more sensitive to the sedating effects of antihistamines than others. Some of that is genetic variation in the histamine system or in drug metabolism. Personalized approaches to sleep medicine based on your specific neurochemistry. That's where things are heading long term.
We might eventually know whether you're an H1 super responder before prescribing anything,
rather than the current approach of try this and see if it knocks you out.
Which, to be fair, is still the approach I take with leaf medicine.
Your leaf medicine is not FDA approved.
It's ancestrally approved. That's better.
It's really not.
Agree to disagree. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word avast, as in the nautical command, to stop or cease, entered English through Dutch seafarers in the early 1700s. Derived from the Dutch phrase, hou vast, meaning hold fast. The term was common in Cape Verdean port towns by the 1910s, where English, Dutch, and Portuguese-speaking crews mingled, making it a rare example of a docking command that crossed three languages before becoming standardized in maritime English.
Cape Verdean port towns. I did not have that on my bingo card. All right, so here's what I'm taking away from this conversation. The histamine system isn't a contradiction. It's a window into how evolution repurposes chemical signals across different tissues. What looks like two unrelated functions is actually a coherent vigilance system that spans the immune system and the brain. And understanding the biology lets us design drugs that target exactly the function we want. Allergy relief without sedation, wakefulness without jitters, acid suppression without brain fog.
The practical point for anyone listening, if you're using diphenhydramine regularly for sleep, talk to your doctor about alternatives. The science has moved on, and there are better options now.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.